I value friendships and relationships. If forced to choose, I would rather be happy than right. I also believe in live and let live. And I try not to offer advice to anyone who hasn't asked me for it. But there are times when it just doesn't feel okay to be silent. I once sat across the table from a man I admired and loved and respected. He was talking in a way I hadn't heard him talk before, using some rather sexist language by way of inviting me to rant with him on the general theme of, you know how women are. I declined the offer and weighed my options while I waited for a pause in the action. I could respond in my most icy tone. No, I don't know how women are. I thought they were people like us. Or I could ask, what have I ever done to make you think it was okay to talk that way around me? Or I could say nothing. Fortunately, I remembered once again what my grandmother used to say to me whenever I was unkind or untruthful. Just listen to yourself. It worked on me. It might work on him. So I said, do you remember the way people used to talk about race down where we come from? And how such language would sound in today's world? Oh, yeah, he said, cringing. It was awful. I took a deep breath and said, if we're going to talk that way about women, how do you think that's going to sound to us 10 years from now, or 20, or however long it takes us to wake up? He stared at me. I could see the storm building behind his eyes. And I'm afraid of lightning. But it was too late to stop now. It's not the same thing, but it kind of is, isn't it? I said. Silence. Yeah, he finally said. I reckon that's right. Short pause. So how about those Astros? Principles matter. Righteous causes matter. Standing up for absent friends is imperative. But there's more at stake than my own integrity. There's also the dignity of the person in front of me. When I feel I have to say something, what's my motive? To put them down or to lift them up? Is it to say, I'm better than you? Or is it to say, we're better than this?
I know, I'm not even the theist, right? Not that amen means you believe in God. People keep saying that. All right. We began this service by quoting the first of our seven Unitarian Universalist principles. We covenant to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. We have seven principles to which we aspire. We also have sources that inform our faith. How many sources do we have? Louder. Six. We have six sources. They're inside your gray hymnal. If you turn to the first hymn and then you turn, you don't have to do this, but they're there. If you turn the first hymn and then you go back a page, that's where they are. The second of our sources is words and deeds of prophetic people. And they don't mean telling the future. They mean speaking power to justice. Justice to power. Words and deeds of prophetic people which challenge us to confront powers and structures of evil, with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love. There is a UU spiritual development program called Wellspring that takes that second source and makes it a personal question for all Unitarian Universalists to consider. That is, consider your own prophetic voice. How do your own words and deeds challenge others to confront powers and structures of evil with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love? Think about your own life. When have you led or joined in social action? Marches, community organizing, GVAT style, advocacy work. When have your words and deeds confronted the powers that need to change? What first pops to mind? When have you spoken up in the face of some racist or transphobic or otherwise hurtful comment in a classroom or a workplace or social gathering at a cafe with a friend like David did? What have you learned from people with marginalized identities different from your own? And how has that learning affected your deeds and words? We Unitarian Universalists are called to defend the inherent worth and dignity of every person, to confront powers and structures of oppression. When we fight an oppression that targets a people whose identity is different from our own, that is being an ally. So think about how you have served as an ally. Maybe you are an able-bodied person who works against ableism, a settler who works toward truth and reconciliation, or a cisgender person who speaks out against transphobia. I don't know about you, but I have found that the work of allyship can be tricky. It is hard to do it well and easy to do it badly. For me, this work of allyship has been a continual learning process. Here are a couple of things that I've learned over the years that I'm guessing you have too. I've learned that effective allyship requires that A, we engage in relationship, and that B, we take the lead from the people with the marginalized identity. So we don't determine on our own what we think would be helpful. We don't go parachuting in, telling people what to do and how we can save them. Instead, we say with humility, I care about this issue. Is there anything I can do to help? We listen. We take direction from people with the lived experience of the oppression. A more recent learning for me is that our own attempts at allyship can be rendered ineffective if, while trying to build that relationship, we are constantly saying things that are unintentionally hurtful. Our intercultural blunders. I have a video with some examples. You've probably never done most of these, but it gives you an idea of the kinds of things that people say when they are not trying to be hurtful, but the effect is hurtful.
You got a scholarship because you're a minority, right?
Where are you from? I mean, where are you really from? You were born in Fort Wayne?
You look like one of those terrorists.
Did you grow up on a reservation?
I bet you're a good dancer.
You don't look gay.
You have a girlfriend?
Were you born that way?
Ni hao. I actually don't do that. Ever.
Hey, do you know any good Mexican restaurants around here?
You like fried chicken, right?
So you were in the army. Did you ever kill anybody?
Do you have internet where you come from?
Is it true you're terrible drivers?
Oh my gosh, can I touch your hair? Is this okay? Are you a man or a woman?
How'd you learn to speak English so well? Maybe because I was born and raised in Iowa?
You're so articulate.
Do you know any terrorists?
Why are you and your friends so loud?
Do you have PTSD?
Why do you wear that thing
on your head.
You have a scholarship for basketball, right?
Are you from Ecuador? Is that like a third world country?
You can't feel anything below your waist, so how do you...
Why do you wear that?
Really? You're studying engineering?
I bet you are good at math. So, like, what's your deal? I mean, ethnically speaking.
What's up?
What's up?
What's up?
Just because I'm black, I don't actually say what's up.
The video is from the States, obviously, but rest assured, this stuff happens in Canada as well. Canadians with brown skin report getting that relentless "where are you from" question all the time, even if the answer is Toronto for three generations. And I bet Canadians of Chinese descent who have lived in Victoria for generations are told that they speak English really well. In both cases, the message they hear is, "I don't expect you to be from here. You don't belong." I want to underscore that saying these things, especially when we do say them with good intentions, does not make us bad people. It just means that to be good allies, we have to do the work of listening when the people with the marginalized identities tell us what kinds of words or actions are hurtful. To be good allies, we have to set aside intent and focus on impact. Ideally, our congregations could become allyship learning spaces. This is my dream. Places where we can help one another learn how to be effective allies on all sorts of issues. A small example from this past week, I was emailing someone and used the phrase cisgender male. First of all, the person was open enough to ask, "What do you mean by cisgender?" So then I was able to explain that a cisgender person is someone whose gender identity matches the biological sex that they were designated at birth. For example, my sex at birth was designated as female, and I identify as a woman, so I am a cisgender woman. Transgender people and gender non-binary people are not cisgender. Secondly, in the course of looking up my definition to make sure I got it right, I realized that I had misspelled cisgender and my phrasing was off. Cisgender is all one word, no hyphens, and it starts with C-I-S, not C-Y-S, which is what I did. And generally, people say, "I am a cisgender man," not "I am a cisgender male." That last bit I couldn't figure out online, so I asked someone who knew more than me. The point is, the more we help one another do this kind of learning, the better allies we can become. The thing about a lot of prejudice and unconscious bias these days is that it comes out in ways that are so subtle, it's sometimes hard to catch ourselves at it and hard to understand why it can be hurtful. This is why I find the term microaggression so useful. All those examples in the video were microaggressions, statements that were not necessarily intended to harm, but that have a harmful and demeaning effect, especially when experienced again and again and again. And like I said, they're sometimes so subtle, it can be hard to explain why they are hurtful. We are getting better at it, though. There's this scene that I saw the other day in one of my favorite TV shows, a sitcom called Mixed-ish. The setting is in the 1980s. A white male lawyer says to a black female lawyer, "This report you wrote is actually really pretty good." The scene pauses and the narrator cuts in, "Today, we would call this a microaggression. In the 80s, we called it a compliment." The term microaggression helps us to identify and call out those subtler ways in which prejudice is voiced and does harm. I find it helpful to practice. How would you explain to a friend why that supposed compliment has a hurtful impact? "This report is actually pretty good." Maybe you would say, that the actually shows the white man's surprise that the black woman's work is good, which reveals a prejudiced belief that black people or women or both are less skilled, less intelligent. The pretty good as an extra layer of condescension. The more we practice figuring out and explaining why these things are hurtful, the better allies we will become. I myself am passionate about this kind of learning, and I know some others in the congregation who have volunteered to be sounding boards for this kind of learning as well. So if questions arise in your attempts to be an ally, please ask. We won't know all of the answers, but we can help find them out together. And if you know a lot of this stuff and would be willing to be one of our listening partners, please let me know that as well. It's especially helpful when those of us who have a particular kind of privilege can help one another learn, so we don't put the burden on the person with a marginalized identity to always be the educator. So, for example, white people can help white people understand racism, and cisgender folks can talk with one another and with Google about why it is helpful to put our pronouns on our name tags. As a white settler 10 years new to Canada, one of my biggest learning curves has been learning how to be an ally with Indigenous people. A week ago, Saturday, 44 Victoria Unitarian Universalists participated in a workshop led by the Indigenous Perspective Society. We learned about the legacy of colonialism, about intergenerational trauma, about suffering and resilience, about how to develop intercultural intelligence. We were given lots of resources, including helpful lists of do's and don'ts. You would think that some of the don'ts would be obvious, like the list of colloquialisms that can be hurtful, but it wasn't until I moved up here and started learning about truth and reconciliation that it occurred to me that I shouldn't use the term powwow. Oops. Shauna told you she had a similar realization about the phrase circle the wagons. Near the end of the workshop, we were given a handout with an exercise that we did not have time to do that day. I am inviting all participants and any of you who wish to join us to engage in this exercise next Sunday, February 2nd, after the service. The exercise lists 8 statements. Here are 3 examples. I wouldn't have thought you were Native. Your skin is so pale. People would listen more to Indigenous people if they were less angry. I really like Native spirituality. In fact, I like to smudge my own home when I have a guest coming. First, we are supposed to match the 8 statements in column A with the 8 possible interpretations in column B, possible negative messages that could be conveyed by each statement. I think, for example, that the statement directed at the pale-skinned Indigenous person could be matched with the interpretation that states, Indigenous people all look the same. Physical traits are what make someone Indigenous. After we match the statements to the negative messages they may convey, the next assignment is to rewrite the statement in a biased, neutral language. I struggled with this. At first, for most of them, I just wrote, just don't say it. But I pushed myself to try to follow the intention and see if there was something else I could say. How would you rewrite, people would listen more to Indigenous people if they were less angry? Yikes. Here's my attempt. White fragility and defensiveness prevents many white settler people from listening to Indigenous people when they get angry. I wonder how I, as a white settler person, can help other white settler people hear and understand the deep injustices and harm that evoke the anger. Or maybe it would be more honest to say, as a Euro-descended settler from a conflict-averse culture, anger can make me feel fearful, guilty, or defensive. But I know I need to push through that and listen anyway to the pain and injustice that evoke the anger. What about the other ones? What could possibly be an acceptable, bias-neutral rewrite of, I wouldn't have thought you were a native, your skin is so pale? Or, I really like native spirituality. In fact, I like to smudge my home when I have a guest coming. I would love, love, love to hear your ideas. Please come to the workshop next Sunday, February 2nd, 12 to 1, in the Farmhouse Common Room. I will also note that there is one more space left in the evening session of the Indigenous Film Discussion Series. See your order of service for details. The more we help one another with this kind of learning, the more we will develop our cultural intelligence, the less unintentional harm we will do in relationship, and the more effective we will be as allies. So that's my vision of our congregation becoming a learning center in which we're all open about our ignorance and are willing to ask questions and help each other learn. That's all well and good when we're asking one another for help. What do we do when we hear someone say something hurtful, but they are not asking for our help in learning? In many cases, they may not even know that what they said is hurtful. It can be all kinds of uncomfortable. You don't want to scold or shame them. You don't want to sound like a self-righteous know-it-all. But to stay silent feels like a betrayal. Allies speak up. That's part of being an ally. So what do you do? Do you do what David did, find a gracious way to lead the person to their own reevaluation of their own behavior? Do you affirm their good intentions? I know you don't mean any harm. Have you thought about the negative message that your words could convey? I have a colleague who says that when someone says something offensive, she will sometimes just state, "We're going to disagree about that." And then she waits to see if they ask for more of an explanation. The youth in our Unitarian Universalist movement have adopted the oops, ouch method for calling each other out in a matter-of-fact, non-accusatory way. If someone says something that hurts or offends you, you can say, ouch. In response, the speaker can say, oops. You can also preemptively say oops when you yourself realize that you've misstepped. If someone doesn't understand or more explanation is needed, dialogue ensues in an educational, non-accusatory way. Recall the wording of that question at the beginning, which drew on our second source. How do your words and deeds confront powers and structures of evil with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love? With justice, yes, but also compassion, and most of all, the transforming power of love. It makes me think of the strongest leaders right now in our UU movement, which is right now undergoing a major anti-racist, anti-oppressive overhaul. When I saw our leaders at our General Assembly last June, people of color, transgender folks, and some of the white people too, they had this way of calling us out, of calling us to justice work that was strong and firm, but at the same time, loving. They would call us to account, but call us beloveds. They would say things like, "You know I love y'all, but we gotta do better." Whatever method you use for speaking up against harmful speech, it's good to practice, right? And to talk about the attempts after the fact. I often feel like situations in which speaking up is needed can kind of sneak up on me, and I find myself like a deer in headlights, ill-prepared. Just recently, a partner of a friend of mine, over the course of several conversations, made reference to people who are homeless in a way that made me very uncomfortable. It took me a while to understand what he was saying and whether what he was saying was actually negative. In my unsure state, I countered with some clumsy, compassionate statements affirming the personhood of people without homes. And then later, when he was telling a story about a friend and joked that the friend was so disheveled that he, quote, looked like a homeless person, in knee-jerk shock, I artlessly sputtered something about how I don't think it's okay to talk about people without homes like that. Of course, later, I thought about all the ways I could have done better, ways I could have better articulated how harmful the comments were, but also ways I could have engaged him in a real conversation about it, ways I could have engaged his higher self the way David did with his friend, accessing that transforming power of love. My friend's partner is not a bad guy. If I started there with an affirmation of his loving nature, maybe I would have gotten farther. Being an ally takes practice. It takes having these debriefing conversations with one another so that we can be better and better prepared when this stuff comes up. It probably also takes a spiritual practice that regularly connects us to and grounds us in that transforming power of love. That's why we're doing this, right? Because our seventh principle affirms that we are all interconnected in this web of life. So when I hear about Indigenous children who were stolen from their parents, it hurts me. And when I hear about stupid bathroom laws that put my transgender friends in danger, I feel angry and I feel scared. It's that agape love that we have for our fellow human beings, that's the love that calls us to the work of allyship. And that's the love, the transforming power of love, that is likely to be our best tool in doing the work. So, how can we be allies with integrity? Here's what I've learned so far. When doing the justice work, engage in relationship, take the lead from the marginalized group. When building that relationship, do our research. Learn about the marginalized group. Learn to identify the microaggressions that demean the group so that we can avoid doing them and can call them out when we see them. Share our learning with one another. Say oops when we mess up. Ouch when we see something hurtful. Practice speaking up. All the while, grounding ourselves in that transforming power of love. This will be an ongoing conversation, I'm sure. For now, let us sing. Nick and Nancy will lead us.